Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The North Carolina General Assembly started their short session last week. Technically, the short session is the second year of the legislature's two-year cycle. It's actually a continuation of the long session, and it sometimes isn't really short. They use this time to take up bills that have already passed one chamber and to adjust the budget. But North Carolina has yet to pass a budget. We're the only state in the union without one and are working from a spending plan from 2023. Senate Leader Phil Berger seems okay with that, but others say it no longer meets our growing needs. So this hour we talk about that, the fact that last week the General Assembly took action on extending Medicaid to the end of the year and other items on their agenda, including the possibility they will put a cap on property tax hikes. Laura Leslie is with us. She is editor at NC Newsline. That's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization focused on in-depth reporting and accountability journalism covering statewide issues. They have a free daily newsletter just for you. She's here along with Sarah Michaels, staff writer for Carolina Public Press, which focuses on investigative public interest reporting across the state. And Adam Wagner is with us. He's editor and a reporter with NC Newsroom. That's a statewide reporting partnership among public radio stations, including WFAE. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Morning.
Morning, Mike.
Good morning. Laura, you've been reporting on the General Assembly for a long time, I think 21 years. So what are the normal expectations for a short session? Should we expect a lot to be done, a lot of loose ends to be tied up? What?
Well, that's my answer is in two parts. Normally, yes, in a short session, you see budget adjustments made, except that we never passed a budget to adjust last year. So there's that. You do tend to see a lot of things like conference reports, things that are last minute negotiations do tend to get wrapped up in those final days. However, and the caveat here, this is not a normal short session because we have one of the leaders of one of the chambers, Phil Berger, who lost his primary and is a lame duck. And we've never had a situation like that before where one of the leaders of one of the chambers wasn't coming back into office at all. So that leaves us kind of up in the air as to what that really means for negotiations, for what the Senate's position is going to be. Are they going to stay behind Berger? Are some of them going to sort of break off and form their own coalition? You know, it's very difficult to say.
Yeah, he lost by 23 votes in a really surprising upset, but he's not the only one to be leaving, not the only incumbent to be going. How many other members are preparing to depart, and what might that mean, Laura, for the work that needs to get done or that will or will not get done?
There are several a few of which were actually targeted by their own party. And I think the three we're watching the most closely are Representatives Carla Cunningham and Nasif Majid from your neighborhood down there in Mecklenburg County. They both lost their Democratic primaries, and so did Shelley Willingham from Edgecombe County. All three of those are Democrats in the House who occasionally vote with the Republicans to override Governor Stein's vetoes. And last year, some of the party activists decided they'd had enough of it, and they decided to back primary challengers, and all three of these folks lost their seats. Now, they've all served for, especially Carla Cunningham and Shelley Willingham, they've served a long time. So it's hard to know what that's going to mean for the remaining veto overrides that are still out there, because they have nothing to lose. You know, do they show up? Do they stick with the party because that's where their principles are? Or do they decide to take a little bit of revenge?
I'm not sure where their principles are. When we're talking about Carla Cunningham and Nasif Majid, Sarah, Carla is a Mecklenburg County representative, and over the weekend she declared that she was going to switch party affiliations away from the Democratic Party to becoming an independent, and just yesterday Nasif Majid took exactly the same step. So what, if anything, does that do to the balance of power in the House? I mean, are they going to caucus with the Democrats? Are they going to caucus with the Republicans? Will it change their voting pattern at all, do you think?
I think from both ends of it, the Democrats and the Republicans, they're not seeing this as much of a change from how these Democrats already operated. They might have been in the Democratic caucusing with them, but they're, you know, there's a press conference the other day and all the House Democrats were there except for these House Democrats. So they've always kind of been a little bit separate and following their own principles, as Destin Hall would say when they vote. So I don't think it's going to change that much. The one thing we do have to watch, as Laura said, is the veto overrides. There's a few of them that I don't think these lawmakers are going to touch. Like, there's a few that relate to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and they seem pretty staunchly with the Democrats on that side. But there is one that has to do with immigration and whether North Carolina, certain law enforcement agencies have to cooperate with ICE. And I could see potentially some movement on that for either for revenge or for according to their principles.
Adam Nasif Majid yesterday said the decision to change from Democratic Party to independent is rooted in my res this is a quote, in my responsibility to represent people, not party agendas, and to remain grounded in integrity, fairness, and truth. It's similar to what Carla Cunningham said as well. Any way to gauge how long they've felt this way? Is this sudden? What's happening here, do you think?
So Cunningham said in her statement that her fissures with the Democratic Party went back at least 4 years. We saw her, in particular, receive a lot of criticism last summer after some, frankly, pretty xenophobic remarks she made during an immigration debate on the House floor. And Majid is a little more difficult to figure out. He clearly feels somewhat similar to Cunningham, but I don't know that he put as much of a time frame on it. I mean, also remember that in both of these cases, these lawmakers both lost their primaries, and they weren't close. These were like 70-30 in both cases. So voters have decided to go a different direction in these districts.
Which brings me to this. Go ahead, Laura. Go ahead.
I was just going to add, we've heard a lot from both of these folks that they're representing the will of their constituents. But
Right.
I think if you look at the primary results, it's pretty clear that they were not.
Yeah, she said, I came to realize that I want to serve the people, not a party, which sounds very much like what Nasif Majid said yesterday. Being an independent thinker, she says, does not align with party politics, and I will never compromise the needs of my constituents to satisfy a political agenda. Both of them said something very similar here. Both of them lost, as you say, their Democratic primaries by a wide margin. Are they reading the room?
Well,
Laura, well, let's go ahead, Sarah.
people in the community would say no. As you all mentioned, they lost by wide margins. And I did a little bit of a deep dive into these races and some of the forces behind their loss. There was a group of outside organizations, kind of grassroots activist organizations, that have been working hard since essentially 2024 to get outswing Democrats like Cunningham and Majid and some others who have left. And it seems like the voters were mostly focused on the, as you said, the immigration speech that Cunningham made, but also this bill that would help Duke Energy charge consumers while they are constructing electric generating facilities. And that would also cut this interim carbon reduction goal on the way to 2050. The voters seem to be really energized by this bill in particular, and that was one of the veto overrides that happened last session.
I think these two mutations from Democrat to unaffiliated are illustrative of a problem I think anybody in elected office faces. Who do you owe your allegiance to, your own personal principles or to your constituents? And serving constituents seems to be the job, but you have to put your head in the game. Could it be argued that in the case of these two Democrats, now unaffiliated, that the constituents were buying what the Democrats were selling? But those two didn't deliver the product. Is that what happened here, Laura?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think it's clear that both Carla Cunningham and Nazif Majid were fairly moderate Democrats, if not more conservative Democrats. And I think the party has moved a little bit toward the left in the legislature. So I think it's fair for them to say to some extent that the party moved a little bit too far for them. But I think one thing you have to remember about constituents, though, is that the one thing that these people, these representatives, are good at is transactionalism, right? They were able to get things for their constituents by agreeing to vote with the Republicans on those veto overrides. So that brought home some of the funding and some of the programs and the extras that constituents tend to like, right? So there was a pro as well as a con there.
Adam.
But I think one of the challenges here is I'm not entirely sure what they got in the last session for some of these votes. And I think that here everything in North Carolina comes back to we don't have a budget. Mm. And the budget is normally where that would happen. You would get a water plant or funding for a highway or whatever. And that didn't happen in the long session. So that dynamic just wasn't really in play.
I think we'll see it. I think we'll see it as they finish up the budget this year, though, because I think there will be a budget this year.
We keep being told that the bulk of the voters are in the center and that both of the parties have gone to favor the extremes of both parties on the right and the left. If these two folks, Nassif Majid and Carla Cunningham, are more moderate Democrats, isn't that a wise place to be for a person in a party that's in the minority in both the House and Senate to be the voice of reason as opposed to the voice of the far left or the far right? Shara?
Potentially, but there's two things you have to keep in mind. First of all, this was a primary and not everybody shows up to the primary. It tends to be the more dedicated parts of each party tend to be more extreme. So you might not be getting the moderates until November. And the second thing is that there's a lot of math in the legislature going on. These Democrats are essentially keeping Governor Stein from having any sort of veto power. And even moderates might think, well, we want, you know, there to be some balance of power here.
We certainly have a problem, I think, in our primary system, and I think it's rearing its ugly head, not only here, but across the country. Go ahead, Adam.
So two quick thoughts there. One, during the long session, Senator Sidney Batch, who also served in the House at one point, was asked about these lawmakers. And she said, you know, I don't know about the House dynamics, but I can speak to how I handle my caucus. You can vote your conscience on the original bill, but if there's a veto, you are expected to come home. And that's not what these lawmakers did. They did vote their conscience on the original bills, and they stuck with that vote to override the veto. The other thing is, I think this puts a little bit of attention on the timing of the primaries. Having the primary ahead of the short session just leaves a lot of time for lawmakers to be doing real business as lame ducks. And there's more than 20 in the General Assembly right now that are lame ducks, effectively. Yeah. So there's just a lot of business to be done.
She mentioned that she experienced a, quote, troubling wave of hostility directed against her. And she blamed Governor Stein and the state party for that. Did that come after her comments that she made, the controversial comments about immigrants and immigration that she made, or did it come after the votes that she cast that helped Republicans and not Democrats?
I think it started with the votes, but I don't think anybody was going to take the extra step until she made that speech. I think it takes a lot for the party or the governor to actively endorse an opponent of a sitting incumbent. I don't think, like, even in the case of Shelley Willingham, who also lost his primary, Governor Stein didn't step in there, but he did step in against Carla Cunningham.
So we have these two incidences on the Democratic side with Carla Cunningham and Nassif Majid of their taking their defeats in the primary not terribly well and divorcing themselves from that party and moving toward independence. We have another instance of somebody not taking ownership of defeat, and that is in Phil Berger, and we'll talk about that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the short session which got underway last Tuesday in Raleigh with the General Assembly. Laura Leslie is here. She's reported on this body for 21 years. She's the editor of NC Newsline, which produces a daily newsletter for your consumption. Sarah Michaels is here. She's staff writer for North Carolina Public Press. And Adam Wagner is editor and a reporter for NC Newsroom. When Senate Leader Phil Berger lost by 23 votes, to his credit, he conceded, and that could not have been an easy thing for him to do because he is, or was, and probably still is to a great degree, the most powerful politician in the state of North Carolina. But just before the start of the short session last week, he took questions from reporters, and here's how he described his defeat. He blamed the Democrats.
I think that Democrats like to vote in some Republican primaries. I think that's the message.
Laura, do we have any figures on how many Democrats chose to vote in the Republican primary in Guilford and Rockingham counties, which are his home counties? And if we don't have those figures, does he?
I suspect you probably could get a lot of the figures for the people who are registered Democrats who chose. Well, no, you can't. Actually, then we'd all have to be unaffiliated because you can't choose a Republican ballot if you're a registered Democrat. But more to the point, there are not very many Democrats in Rockingham County, and that's the county that he lost. You know, he won in Guilford County, mm-hmm. which is the county, ironically, that has more Democrats. Rockingham County, his home county, is a very deep red district. So it's hard to believe that Democrats there could have had much, if any, influence over how that race turned out.
So Berger go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was on the ground on election day in Rockingham in Guilford County. And when I was talking to voters, I mean, it wasn't like they were really against Berger or Page. They tended to like them both. And it was more of a, I don't know, like, where's the marginal difference in here? It didn't seem like a Democrat versus Republican issue.
Adam.
I'd also just say this is the system we have, and that Senator Berger knew those rules going into the election. And everyone knew that there was going to be attention from unaffiliated voters. I mean, it is logical that an unaffiliated voter will take the ballot that has the most important election on it. And Berger versus Page was the most important election in the state. So it's not surprising.
So you'd want to vote in that primary to make a difference in one way or the other. Berger stays until the end of this session, which goes, who knows, and has no say in who his successor will be, Adam. Has the jockeying for position begun as we approach, as the session continues? We're only a week into it, but has it begun? And will we see, do you think, his grip on the General Assembly and the Senate in particular slip away?
So we have not seen any jockeying break into public. We know that there are three senators seeking power of the chamber. That's Senator Ralph Heiss from Spruce Pine, Senator Michael Lee from Wilmington, and Senator Todd Johnson from Union County. As far as Berger's power, I don't think so, at least as of yet. That chamber has a lot of people that are pretty dedicated to Berger and really have now worked with him for 15 years at least in leadership, and a lot of the sort of power seats are Berger allies.
One of the first things that lawmakers tackled last week at the start of the short session was funding Medicaid through the end of the year. It was set to run out in October. Now that won't happen. Did it surprise anyone, Sarah, that this happened so quickly and with bipartisan support?
You know, it actually didn't surprise me, even though last session was the whole entire session we were waiting for this, and there were court cases and a lot of situations, because there's an election this year and this issue has reached the public consciousness and everybody is generally upset that the General Assembly hasn't passed a budget, which includes Medicaid. And I think Republicans, including leadership, forecast that if they didn't do something, not only would people probably start losing some health care, voters were going to pay attention to that and potentially punish them in November.
Laura.
I would also add that in a lot of rural districts, which is really where most of the Medicaid expansion folks were, right, the Medicaid recipients, a lot of those counties, the healthcare system is the largest employer. So if you are not paying Medicaid and Medicaid is not paying their providers, you're looking at a massive economic hit to your counties, you know, as well as a you know, public health and human services problem. And that's something that a lot of these more rural districts certainly, I'm sure, heard a lot about. There was a time last fall when Governor Stein, whether you agree with this or not, cut some of the reimbursement rates to try to slow the rate that Medicaid was paying out the money because it was going to be short. And even just those small cuts caused a lot of uproar in a lot of these small counties.
Yeah, Adam.
So I think it's important just to note that this had to happen. I mean, the state's Medicaid was going to run out of money at some point before the end of the fiscal year. It had this the money had to be allocated. There's also a lot of other things in that bill that are either important or reforms to Medicaid that, like, for instance, it shifts around some funding from the hospital tax so that Medicaid expansion stays in place. That hasn't gotten really any attention, but is really important. It also does a little bit to kick about 27,000 people off of Medicaid who are new to the country by kind of removing an exemption that North Carolina had for this 5-year waiting period. So there's just a bunch of other little sort of technical things in there. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about some of those later today when this is debated on the House and Senate floor for a third reading.
I want to
I
talk
was
about
kind
some
of
of.
sorry.
Go
I
ahead.
was just kind of surprised how quickly that went through last week. And I felt like there wasn't a whole lot of debate. And I wondered how well people were informed about what the bill actually did, because it was interesting to hear Senate Democratic leader Sidney Batch, who supported it, turn around and say, "Hey, wait, I don't think I do support it." So it's like, how much notice did anybody have about this bill, and how much of a chance did they get to actually review it?
And I
Yeah,
think
there are a
that gets
lot.
back to there's the one thing that they have to vote for in there, and then a bunch of other, just a bunch of other pieces that are going to, I think a lot of Democrats are going to hold their nose and vote for it today, and then come back and say, but I really didn't like this, this, and this.
Yeah, I mentioned that it passed with bipartisan support, but it was overwhelming. It was 112 to 1 in the House, 48 to 1 in the Senate. Who were the holdouts?
They were
And
both
why?
from Guilford County. It was Pricey Harrison and also, sorry, Michael Garrett from Guilford County. So apparently they had discussed it.
Which party are they from? Let me guess.
Democrats. Democrats.
Democrats, yes. Because there are some requirements that came along with the passage of this, along with a performance audit and restrictions on the use of Medicaid, including work requirements. A lot to swallow for some Democrats. Coverage excludes, for instance, undocumented immigrants and removes the ability for refugees who have a green card but not citizenship to receive benefits. First, Adam, do we have any undocumented immigrants on the Medicaid rolls?
No, undocumented immigrants can't get Medicaid. So the thing that is changing though is this element where some refugees were eligible for Medicaid, but that changed with H.R. 1, the big beautiful bill that passed last summer. And also this waiting, some people who are new to the country, children and pregnant women, North Carolina can waive a 5-year waiting period for them, and North Carolina has. And this bill rolls that back. It says that North Carolina's Medicaid will only be available basically at the minimum level required by the federal government. So the DHHS estimates that's 27,000 people that come off the rolls.
Laura.
I would add that there is something there that is problematic to Democrats, and that is the addition of a requirement that the people who work in Medicaid, for example, who are enrolling a family, let's say, or a pregnant woman who would be, eligible for services, that if they do not, if they don't, if they're not able to prove that they're in the country legally, then this requires those HHS staff to report them to ICE. And that is something that there was some heartburn about, especially among immigrant groups, because there's a lot of mixed families, mixed status families, where, say, the parents are in the country and they're not here legally, but the children are here legally. Well, if you're a parent who is not here with legal status, do you take your child in knowing that you're risking getting reported to ICE? And even though your child may need medical care. So, I mean, that's a tough issue.
And then there was that provision about refugees who have a green card but not citizenship now are ineligible to be Medicaid recipients. So what happens? You mentioned, Laura, that Medicaid benefits particularly rural hospitals. What happens if these people get sick? Do hospitals get stuck with the bill now?
Yes, they wait till they're really sick and then they go to the ER, and then that costs a lot more money than it would cost to send them to primary care in the first place. But there's not a good way to track that. We don't have a lot of data on exactly what that costs, which makes it a little bit easier for folks to sort of ignore that.
Sarah, the last comprehensive budget that we passed in the state was in 2023. We have yet to pass a budget for this fiscal year. Some say that relying on a budget that is nearly 3 years old is bad because the state has changed and it has grown a lot in that time. So that budget no longer fits our needs. Governor Stein recently pointed out that since the last budget passed, quote, we added 325,000 people, experienced 6% inflation, suffered the most damaging natural disaster in the history of the state, Helene, and are living through a federal government pushing hundreds of millions of dollars of expenses onto the state that it used to cover. On the other hand, Senate Leader Phil Berger sees this as a positive.
It's a reflection of the fact that we have put the state of North Carolina on a pathway that allows the government to continue to function for core services and does that in a way, even if we are unable to reach agreement at the legislative level.
Which side is correct, Sarah?
Well, I couldn't say that, but yeah, it's interesting. North Carolina does not work the same way the federal government works. In the federal government, if you don't come into a deal, the government shuts down. And we've all heard about that many times. In North Carolina, it doesn't work like that. You just continue operating on the last budget that was passed, which was 2023. This is currently hurting people like teachers, law enforcement, state employees who haven't got raises, and there's a lot of inflation going on right now, so they might effectively be making less. And there's also, you know, projects that cities across North Carolina might have wanted money for in the budget that they're not getting. So there's a lot that hasn't been taken care of.
Laura. I would just add to that that Berger is right theoretically. Okay, so I mean, in fact, the state can keep going. It just keeps going on the same budget it was using in 2024. He's talking about core services, for example. But there's no adjustment for inflation and there's no adjustment for population growth factored into that, right? If there were, then you could probably make the argument that the state could continue to function just fine. But that's not part of the equation. So they're still providing the same services to more people with the same amount of money that actually is worth less. So, I mean, to argue that somehow it's going to continue as it has been is, I think, probably ignoring the economic reality.
Adam?
To that point, I think that the longer that you go without a budget, the more the weak parts start to show. We've heard from the state prisons, for instance, that are saying that they have to ask their vendors to just wait basically to take money because they are so far in the black, in the red. We're seeing that in the Medicaid bill shifts about, I think it's $80 million over to the state prisons to try to make good on some of these bills. And that's money that would traditionally just have been part of the budget last summer that didn't get passed.
A lot of the impasse here, all of the impasse here is between the budget that was developed in the House and the budget that was developed in the Senate, and the fact that Phil Berger and Destin Hall and his and their cohorts can't come to an agreement. So we have these slightly different versions. But now Phil Berger is, as you pointed out, Laura, a lame duck. Will he have the power to stop any kind of compromise? Will he be more willing to compromise with the House? Will we see movement despite any objections from Phil Berger? Laura.
That's what I wonder, because there are, you know, there are some members of his caucus that are not in real strong districts. Michael Lee, for example, was one of the people who wants to replace him. He's in a pretty swing district. And I think it's going to be very difficult for those incumbents to go home in November if they still haven't passed a budget after being here for 2 years. So I think there's going to be pressure on him, even if he doesn't want to come to a deal on the tax cuts, there's going to be pressure on him to find one from those folks who have to go home and run for reelection.
But if you're not a teacher or you're not a state employee, do you really notice that we haven't passed a budget since 2023, Sarah?
Well, you have to keep in mind the last session, you know, the lawmakers didn't pass that many bills and we haven't passed a budget. So lawmakers don't have really that much they can point to that said, hey, I brought home this $100 million project to our district and that's why you should reelect me. So without a budget, people might not notice the absence of something, but they're noticed they're not really getting anything.
But that's kind of a mirror image of what's happening in Washington. They're not doing much either and they keep getting reelected. Laura?
I would also offer that, again, we're back to the rural counties situation. Out there, it's hard to find somebody who is not a teacher, a state employee, or a healthcare worker in a lot of those counties because those are your major employers. And so you're right. If you're not one of these people, you may not be paying that much attention to it, but chances are you're in the household with one in a lot of these counties. So chances are you probably know.
Adam.
Senator Berger showed a willingness last week, I thought, to compromise that we hadn't heard from him before on this income tax trigger issue. Basically, he said that he was, they said they were willing to take a look at the triggers and maybe not lower the tax rates quite as quickly. And that was brand new. He had been dead set on, we signed this into law, we are going to stick with this plan that we made. And the House wants to do it slower, but the Senate's not going to do it slower at all. So I think that if they can get that ironed out, the rest of this will fall into place very quickly. I would not be surprised if we come back some Monday or Tuesday and there's suddenly a budget agreement sooner than later.
Yeah, I want to come back to the idea of these tax cuts in a sec. We don't have enough time to explore it in this segment because we're about to run up to a break. But sticking with the budget for just a second, and teacher and state employee pay raises, teachers are now almost at the bottom of the heap in terms of how much money they're making when you compare it to teachers in the rest of the country. Is the bulk of the agreement, disagreement between the House and the Senate over the budget about what the amount of money teachers should be getting when the raises come through, or is it about these tax cuts that are set to come into play? Laura.
It's two sides of the same coin because if you have the tax cuts, you don't have the extra money to give the teachers the bigger raises, right? So that's why the House proposed bigger raises and delaying the tax cuts, and the Senate proposed going forward with the tax cuts but smaller raises.
Well, everybody wants a tax cut. So that's got people's ears perked up, and we'll get to that when we come back in a moment. But there's another side to that coin, too, and that's a property tax cap, which sounds good on the surface, but a lot of people in places like Wake County and Mecklenburg County who are in public office say, wait a minute, that is a really bad idea, and we'll tell you why when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the legislative short session, which got underway last Tuesday. They passed Medicaid. They continued funding Medicaid through the end of the year. And now we're talking about a budget, which we haven't had in quite a while. And we're talking about it with Laura Leslie, editor of NC Newsline. Sarah Michaels is here, staff writer for the North Carolina Public Press. And Adam Wagner, editor and reporter for NC Newsroom. Adam, if they pass a budget, and I think they probably will, I think everybody on this panel agrees that at some point in this session they will pass this budget. How long will it be in effect? I mean, we haven't, they usually pass these budgets in the long session, which I think is coming up next year. So, how long will this budget be in effect?
Till the long session, or until, I mean,
So we start all over again.
This would effectively be the 2-year budget that would have normally been passed last summer. So it would include both the base budget and also hypothetically the adjustments that would have typically happened in the short session. Now, that doesn't preclude them from coming back in September or November and saying, oh, we really want to make some change to something, passing a sort of different kind of adjustment bill. I mean, anyone that's covered North Carolina politics, anyone that follows North Carolina politics knows that everything is always on the table. So, but yeah, this would be the biennium's budget.
And next year, Laura will have a new Senate leader, whoever that may end up being. Could that person push for substantial changes to whatever passes this time around?
Certainly. And they'll also have a hand in writing the next long session budget, assuming we have one, that is. This could we could have this one for a while. Keep that in mind. Yeah, they will definitely have the opportunity to put their stamp on it. We'll see. Perhaps they'll have the opportunity to put their stamp on it this year. We don't know yet.
Sarah, one of the stumbling blocks we don't talk about on this program a lot with regard to passage of this budget, and we don't talk about it because it doesn't really affect Mecklenburg, and that is the fact that there's this children's hospital as part of this budget that Phil Berger and the previous House Speaker Tim Moore agreed to, but which Dustin Hall, the current House Speaker, has a quite has a different point of view on why is Hall less excited about this hospital?
Right. Hall apparently was in the room when this deal was made. Berger will tell you that. But he doesn't really see the need for a standalone children's hospital. He said, well, we already have a substantial health care for children, so I don't think we really need this. And I think he would rather pay for other things. But, you know, this has really been a point of disagreement between the two leaders. And I think, you know, it's a more principle than anything for Berger right now.
Adam, I know you want to chime in, but where is this hospital going to be located?
So the plan would be that it is in Apex in southwestern Wake County. It would be a joint partnership of UNC Health and Duke Health. Those are two of the three major hospital systems operating in the Triangle. And I think that one thing that kind of gets lost in this whole discussion is that we're not just talking about the hospital. There's also funding for a UNC Health partnership that would set up some rural health clinics that kind of gets rinsed into this conversation, that funding will be pulled as well. And Senate folks will tell you that, you know, they're talking about rural health. Shouldn't they be on board with, the House should be on board with this part of this, this package that should also be on board with the hospital.
Laura?
And there was also the question of how much the state should be paying for a children's hospital, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was kind of what I got out of Hall, is that it's not that anybody thinks that it's not a good idea to have another children's hospital. But the question is, should, when you've got these two big, incredibly well-funded health systems putting this thing together, what does the state need to put in $500 million? Or should the state rethink that and let the hospitals use their foundations to pay for that?
Adam.
And this would be funded with money from the ACA, the early, now 4 or 5 years ago, COVID era package. So this is not like state taxpayer money. This is money that I think does have an expiration date at some point. It's not like imminent, but it can go away if you don't use it. And it's just from this kind of special pot.
So budgets are about inflow of money and outflow of money. And Laura, you report that tax cuts, which were approved years ago, are set to take effect if state revenues reach certain levels. But both House Republican leader Destin Hall and Governor Josh Stein, Republican and a Democrat, believe the revenue triggers did not anticipate the rapid inflation that we've been experiencing. So what has inflation done to state expenditures, and what might those tax cuts do as a result?
Yeah, the projections are that the state is going to basically be in a deficit budget position in a couple of years if these go forward. And, you know, they set these triggers thinking that at the time that they were quite generous and that there's no way the state wouldn't be able to function on this amount of money, but nobody saw the amount of inflation that we've seen over the last several years, right? So they just didn't take into account how much more it was going to cost the state to function than it is now. And I mean, you know, as much as we've all seen our inflation go up, the state's seen even more, because some of the things that the state spends the most money on, things like construction and roads, those are things that have gotten very, very expensive as fuel prices have gone up and tariffs, you know, have come into play. And, you know, the state definitely is spending a lot more money than I think anybody projected that it would need.
Yeah. Some have said, Sarah, that enacting these tax cuts, as Laura alluded to, will send the state over a financial cliff, a fiscal cliff. Has that kind of talk increased as they've been debating this budget? Is it increasing in the short session? Because this was talk that we heard 6 months, 7 months, 8 months ago.
You know, I think this talk has existed for a long time, but whether Republicans are listening to it, particularly Senate Leader Berger, is another question. You know, there's consensus revenue forecasts that come out every once in a while. And last year there was a forecast that came out that seemed to indicate that in the 2028 tax cut would, you know, be very narrowly missed, and Berger wanted to go ahead with it anyways. But the most recent one has reversed that. Now we have a little bit of a surplus, so we should be good. Regardless, people on the other side are saying this revenue fiscal cliff is an issue, but Berger says he doesn't really buy the estimates from this group.
Yeah, Berger has said that these tax cuts were a promise to the people of the state and that we need to stick to them, Adam. How does Destin Hall feel about it?
So the House position is that the tax cuts should go into effect, but more slowly than they were originally laid out. So, and that feels like it's where a compromise between the House and Senate position might be. Just kind of move the revenue triggers a little bit, or put some kind of timing on it, because kind of like Laura said, part of the problem right now is with inflation, with the war, with healthcare costs, with the impacts of the Big Beautiful Bill. There's just an awful lot of uncertainty all around state government. Yeah. And in the House position, I think also the governor's position, is it might not be a great time to remove millions and millions of dollars from tax rolls.
I think there's uncertainty everywhere in the country at the moment. Well, Laura, go ahead. Before
I just wanted to add to that, I heard what Sarah said about, he said that he doesn't believe the consensus, revenue forecast. These are his people. These are the legislative staff who advise them on all this other stuff, right? And they sit down with the governor's Office of State Budget Management, and they're the ones that come up with these predictions, right? So if you can't believe them, I don't know who you're going to believe.
So in this short session, the General Assembly is also considering a constitutional amendment. They would pass this. It would then go onto the November ballot for voters to say yes or no to. But it would be a constitutional amendment requiring the General Assembly to limit government's ability to increase revenue through property taxes. Those are taxes levied by counties and cities in the state of North Carolina, not by the legislature. The amendment would cap how much those entities could increase property tax collections each year. It's already passed one committee in the House. It would have to pass the full House before going on to the Senate. What are the chances, Laura, of passage in either of those bodies?
It sounds like it's pretty good in the House. I'm not sure about the Senate. It's hard to find anybody who doesn't have some kind of story about having their tax bill, their property tax bill, go through the roof because valuations have changed so much. And there's a lot of people feeling sticker shock. And for some of the folks, lower income folks and retirees who've paid their houses off, they're in the position of like literally thinking to have to about having to get rid of their house because they can't afford their tax bill on a fixed income. So there is a reason that they're looking at this. But of course, cities and counties are saying this is not the right way to do this, right? But in the Senate, you've had Senate Leader Berger talking about, let's put a moratorium in place first. Put a hold on these things for a year and then sit down and really study it and figure out what it is that we want to ask the voters to vote for as a constitutional amendment.
Couldn't there be carve-outs for the elderly?
There could be, and there are currently carve-outs for the elderly and for some other groups as well, like veterans and people who are disabled. But right now, the thresholds for those are set so low. Again, they didn't really factor in inflation and they haven't been adjusted, that the vast majority of people are going to make a little bit more than that just to get by, and they're not going to be eligible for that.
Both Sarah and Adam want to chime in on this. Sarah, ladies first.
Hey, the sense I've gotten from this whole conversation is that lawmakers, they want to do something. They're just not sure exactly what's going to move the needle on this issue. It's a very, property tax law is very complicated. But this constitutional amendment is sort of this first step in saying, okay, we don't know what we're going to do next session if you let us do it, but give us some time and we're going to try to fix this issue for you. Like, we see you, we hear you, yeah. We're going to try.
Adam?
Yeah, to that point, kind of like Sarah said, an amendment would just require the General Assembly to do something. It wouldn't tell voters exactly what the policy is that they're voting on. So North Carolina already has a cap on the property tax rate. The idea of going after the total revenue would be that you would mandate that local governments look at the factor in the valuation piece a little bit more into this conversation.
You know, this is the way that counties and cities raise money. This is their principal source of revenue. And each of the members of the General Assembly live in counties. Some of them have been on county commissions or city councils prior to their terms in the legislature. and they know about how they raise revenues through property taxes. Why do they want to do this? Why do they want to limit the ability of counties to raise the money that they need to operate? I'm not sure which one of you can take that answer. Go ahead, Laura.
Basically, they feel that some counties are taking advantage of it. And so, you know, a lot of times when we used to have revaluations, what they used to do is they called it revenue neutral. So everybody would get their tax rate adjusted. So they'd be paying about the same amount of taxes, maybe a little bit more than they were. What they're seeing is counties are increasingly not going revenue neutral. So counties are raising a lot more money, and counties say, we need that money because, you know, we've got people to pay, we've got gas to put in vehicles, you know, we need more money. But, you know, the legislators are looking at the fact that some counties managed to do this without raising a whole lot of tax money, and other counties raise it quite a bit. And they say, it's not fair that they can do that.
There are some counties evidently that have been raising more than perhaps they need. Mecklenburg is not among them, according to all the measures that I've seen. But here in Mecklenburg County, County Commissioner George Dunlap, who used to chair the commission, is very much opposed to this idea. And he offered this example. He said that the county spends $500 million on our schools every year. And he says this is actually the state's responsibility, which is something people in the community need to understand as they contemplate the joy of having this property tax cap put into place.
That's where people are going to get it wrong if they vote for this cap, thinking that they're going to get a reduction. They'd get that reduction if the state funded the system.
So property tax authority has traditionally been almost entirely local. This would shift some of that power to Raleigh. Another thing that Raleigh is taking control of. Is this a unique idea, or has this happened in other states?
Anybody? It's definitely happened in other states. The example that came up in the conversation, I think in committee, was Massachusetts. Like, if you want to understand a levy, Massachusetts' Department of Revenue has put out some really nifty little explainer videos, a levy limit. So it's not totally novel to North Carolina, but certainly the Association of County Commissioners is really opposed to the levy limit idea. They are less opposed to the moratorium idea. The executive director over there, Kevin Leonard, told me that maybe the moratorium is the way to go. Maybe that gives us the second to actually get this right.
So we'll see. So George Dunlap mentioned, used as an example, the schools, and that the state should be funding the schools, and they're not to the right degree. So the county has had to step in, and they have to get their money from someplace. And he wants the public to understand the implications of this, he says, because no one likes taxes. And when they see a constitutional amendment on the ballot limiting what some view as one of the burdens of home ownership, they are likely to vote for it, not understanding what might happen as a result. Sarah, what might happen?
Well, I mean, if you look at most of the counties across the state, half their budget goes to public law enforcement, like public safety law enforcement. And then, as you mentioned, a lot of it goes to education. So these aren't, you know, fun little things that counties decide to do, even though they don't have to. It's the bare bones necessities of running in a community.
Yeah, and a lot of it goes to infrastructure like roads, because the state's also not following up on their responsibility in some areas to fix the roads that they control. So the county has stepped in to do that, and that comes from those property taxes. I'll give you the last word, Laura. Do you expect this short session to be short?
I think I do, because I think they would very much like to get home and on the campaign trail, because it's going to be a tough year election-wise.
Okay. Laura Leslie is the editor of NC Newsline. They have a newsletter that's available. How do they get it? It's free.
It's on our website.
Say it again.
And it's on our website, ncnewsline.com.
Okay. Sarah Michaels, staff writer for North Carolina Public Press, and Adam Wagner, editor and reporter for NC Newsroom. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, Visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.